This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Coming up, with its price tag ballooning, some are saying it's time to go back to the drawing board with the Southwest Light Rail Line project. The first case of avian flu is found in a wild bird in Minnesota. The Minnesota House passes a bill that improves the state's natural resources and the arts. And May Day celebrations in Minnesota feature an Aztec dance troupe. It's Friday, May 1st. I'm John Wanamaker. Now that the ballooning costs of the Southwest Light Rail project have called its future into question, supporters of the project are trying to figure out what to do next. Officials are scrambling to bring down the cost of the LRT to make it more palatable. Peter Cox reports.
The 16-mile line is proposed to run from Minneapolis to Eden Prairie. That's where you'll find early morning commuters lined up 20 deep to get a seat on an express bus that brings them to downtown Minneapolis. Tim Fox has ridden the bus for the past 4 years, and he doesn't see the need for light rail.
It seems like it's a lot of cost for something that's more fun than necessary. Seems there's other places they could probably use it more than Eden Prairie.
Fox says he'd be fine if they scrapped the project altogether. On Monday, Metropolitan Council Chair Adam Dunick said that option is on the table after he learned the new estimated price tag is now nearly $2 billion. That's $341 million more than the previous estimate. So what's pushing up those costs? New environmental tests showed more pollution than expected on the route in Hopkins and St. Louis Park, and engineers would need to do more work to shore up soft soil where the track would go. There's also a one-year delay, which would add about $50 million to the final cost. Longtime Southwest supporter Peter McLaughlin says changing the route would be too expensive.
We've got to just take the sharp pencils out.
McLaughlin is a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners and serves on a committee that advises the Met Council on the design and construction of the Southwest Light Rail. He says engineers are already analyzing different ways to cut costs.
Do you eliminate stations? Do you shorten the route? Do you eliminate these vehicles, things like that? I mean, there's a list, and they need to be generating that list right now. I think we need to act quickly to get that list and then make some hard decisions.
Edina Mayor Jim Hovland also serves on the Southwest Corridor Management Committee. Hovland says one station that could go is the last stop in Eden Prairie, one of three in the city, because that could be added on at a later date. He says that could save $100 million.
And I'm not trying to tell Eden Prairie they should take the hit here, but I think it means that all of us have to look at what we can do to make sure that this project works because of its importance on a regional basis.
Critics of the light rail plan say the new cost estimate should force a complete overhaul of the project, including a reroute. Here's Mary Paddock with the Lakes and Parks Alliance, which filed a federal lawsuit against the project last year.
It's ridiculous the amount of money that they're putting into this and the cost creep. We get numb to that. And there comes a time when you have to look at the cost benefit and say, wait, enough is enough. There's something fundamentally wrong with this project. And I think we're at that spot now.
Back in Eden Prairie, Derek Haywood waits for the Minneapolis-bound express bus. He just got off his overnight shift at Deli Express. The North Minneapolis resident says he would use the light rail a lot.
I commute here Monday through Friday, and on Saturday I have to catch a ride to work. So, I mean, as far as the commute goes, I would like to be commuted on the weekend, even if it's just in the morning or at night. But I think a train, a railing system would be pretty convenient.
A Met Council spokesperson says the Corridor Management Committee will get an update on the Southwest Light Rail next Wednesday. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A Cooper's hawk in Yellow Medicine County has died from the same avian flu strain that's killed millions of domestic birds across the state. The Department of Natural Resources says the hawk is the first wild bird found in Minnesota to test positive for the deadly virus. DNR Wildlife Research Manager Lou Cornicelli says the discovery doesn't provide many clues about how the virus is transmitting to poultry. It's thought that ducks and geese brought the disease into the state, but he says Cooper's hawks don't eat waterfowl, so it's unclear how the raptor became infected.
They're big on mourning doves and small birds that size, and they do eat some. They'll eat small mammals and rabbits on occasion too, but they're well known for bird predators.
Cornicelli says the finding presents another research opportunity to look at what role, if any, other bird species may play in the avian flu outbreak. A third of DFL state senators are asking that some controversial policy provisions be taken out of an environment budget bill. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
The letter to Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach was signed by 13 DFL senators. At issue is an environment finance bill the Senate passed last week. DFL Senator Sandy Pappas of St. Paul initiated the letter. She says the policy provisions would weaken the state's clean water standards.
I just am very hopeful that in the end we'll kind of keep our standing as a state that really cares about clean water, clean air, and support our state agencies and back in their rulemaking process.
Pappas opposed those provisions but voted in favor of the overall environment budget bill. The letter comes a day after Governor Mark Dayton called some of the policy provisions ill-advised. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota House has passed a bill that spends about $540 million to improve the state's natural resources and the arts. The Legacy Fund Appropriation Bill doles out the sales tax revenue collected for four dedicated accounts: outdoor heritage, clean water, parks and trails, and arts and cultural heritage. Republican Representative Dean Erdahl of Grove City, the chair of the House Legacy Funding Committee, said the bill spends the money fairly.
We don't have a baseline budget in that way. The baseline is zero. There are no cuts because one shouldn't assume that that money will be there at that rate forever. And so there shouldn't be any entitlement. It is what we put together each year depending on how much money we have and what the needs are.
DFL Representative Phyllis Kahn of Minneapolis said she likes the bill too, but wishes it had more money for clean water projects. The vote was 97 to 31. Commerce Commissioner Mike Rothman has confirmed that an FBI investigation continues into a troubled nonprofit that was shut down by the state last year. Tom Scheck reports.
During his confirmation hearing before a committee in the Minnesota Senate, Rothman said the Commerce Department is working with several investigative agencies to look into Community Action of Minneapolis. A court-appointed receiver is winding down the nonprofit after an audit found that the agency's CEO, Bill Davis, spent hundreds of thousands of taxpayer dollars on trips, a car lease, and other perks. Rothman said the investigation is ongoing.
The FBI is looking into some of the reports in the DHS document and some of the receiver information.
Rothman declined to comment further about the FBI investigation, but said a separate investigation by his department into Community Action may wrap up in June. Davis has denied any wrongdoing. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
New HIV/AIDS infections increased slightly in Minnesota last year. There were 307 cases in 2014 compared to 300 the previous year. That's a 2% increase. State AIDS Director Chrissy Girard says there's no single explanation for the trend, but she says the Minnesota Department of Health hopes to reduce the infection rate by urging greater use of newly approved HIV preventive treatments.
Getting people that are negative for HIV on a medication if they're high risk to stop the spread of the disease. So that is going to be something that we're looking at expanding on over the next few years.
The majority of HIV/AIDS infections occur in men who have sex with other men. HIV cases among women rose 7% last year. New cases attributed to injection drug use remain low in Minnesota. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. The state will let five rural Minnesota school districts keep their four-day school weeks next school year. Tim Post has more on that.
Education Commissioner Brenda Caselius has given five districts, Black Duck, Lake Superior, McRae, Ogilvie, and Pelican Rapids, permission to keep their shortened weeks for at least one more year. The extensions come as lawmakers are discussing whether to give school boards the power to set the length of their weeks. Josh Collins is the Education Department's spokesperson.
The commissioner felt that given that there's fairly significant discussion going on in both bodies of the legislature on this issue, that we needed to approve that for one year in order to allow this really to get resolved.
School districts say four-day weeks help them save money. The Department of Education says data show they don't improve the performance of students. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
One of the most prominent members of the protest group Black Lives Matter is poised to become the new president of the Minneapolis NAACP this weekend. Nakima Levy-Pounds hopes she can attract some new young members to the nation's oldest civil rights organization. However, the NAACP's outgoing president says her role in the protest group means she's not the best candidate for the job. Brant Williams reports.
Earlier this week, Nakima Levy-Pounds was among hundreds of demonstrators who marched through downtown Minneapolis. The protest was sparked by the death of an African-American man who died in police custody last week in Baltimore. A professor at the University of St. Thomas Law School, Levy-Pounds also runs a civil rights legal clinic at the school. She's a Los Angeles native who moved to Minnesota in 2003. Levy-Pounds says she's running for the presidency of the NAACP because she's concerned about racial disparities in Minneapolis, which are some of the widest gaps in the country.
This is really an opportunity to engage a broader group of stakeholders in this fight for social and racial justice.
There doesn't appear to be anyone running against Levy-Pounds, although it's possible there will be write-in candidates on tomorrow's ballot. But that doesn't mean she's unopposed. Outgoing chapter president Reverend Jerry McAfee, who decided not to run for re-election, says the organization needs to focus more narrowly on issues that directly affect African Americans, such as black-on-black crime. McAfee says he doesn't think Levy-Pounds' involvement with Black Lives Matter is adequate qualification.
So if Black Lives Matter, Black Lives gotta matter even when black folk kill black folks. So always marching 500 or 600 or however many people against the police, which is a good thing, but you need to do that same damn thing in our community.
Levy-Pounds says she's heard that criticism before, and she says it misses the point.
The reality is that if a black person kills another black person, they can expect to be prosecuted. We cannot say the same thing will happen if an officer shoots an unarmed black person.
NAACP branch president served 2-year terms. Brett Buckner served as Minneapolis branch president from 2003 to 2004. He says Levy-Pounds will likely bring some needed energy and new membership to the organization. Buckner says each president comes in with new supporters and agendas. However, he says it may take a while for that new leader to accomplish what they set out to do.
You have a limited ability to change the direction of an organization as storied as the NAACP. There's a set way of doing things. There's a constitution and bylaws that's pretty strict. We report up, you know, regionally and nationally.
Levy-Pounds hopes some of the young and enthusiastic 20-somethings involved in groups like Black Lives Matter will also join up with the NAACP.
And I think that that's what's needed to begin to awaken our community to the fact that if we stand up and fight, if we march, if we rally, if we advocate, then that can lead to change.
Levy-Pounds, who lives in Brooklyn Park and works in Minneapolis, says anyone who lives or works in Hennepin County is eligible to become a voting member of the group. And she says they can do that at the polling site, which is North Point Health and Wellness Center in North Minneapolis. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Employees of the Minnesota Senate are mourning a longtime staffer who was killed by a light rail train in St. Paul yesterday. Lynn Thomas was hit while walking near the intersection of University and Snelling Avenues at about 7:30 Thursday morning. She was pronounced dead at Regents Hospital. Thomas had worked for almost 3 decades for what's now known as Senate Counsel Research and Fiscal Analysis. Tom Bodern directs the office. He says Thomas was known for her welcoming and pleasant demeanor.
Lynn, in a sense, was a rare commodity, someone that you connected immediately with the place where you worked in a very positive way. It was like she was really, you know, almost literally part of the office. And you don't encounter that too often anymore.
The incident is being investigated by Metro Transit Police. It is the second time a pedestrian has been killed by a Green Line train since it started operation last summer. Cheyenne Erickson hit another car in a Twin Cities suburb last summer, gravely injuring a toddler. The 18-year-old Shakopee woman had just read a text when she made a left-hand turn and hit an oncoming car. Now she's talking about what she did. Tim Nelson has her story.
Cheyenne Erickson was heading for summer school one day last July, waiting to make a left turn at an intersection in Eagan. An oncoming car was just about to pass her.
And then I looked down at my phone because I heard it vibrate. So I looked at it and I read the text message from my best friend. And then I put the phone back down because I saw the car like out of my peripheral. And then I turned left before I looked again.
There was another car coming straight for her. The crash knocked Erickson out. She broke an ankle and messed up her knee. A passerby helped her out of the smashed car.
And then I walked across the street, and I just stood there. I wasn't sure what to do next. I was like, what's going on, you know, going into shock. And I was crying. And I remember seeing the other car with the passengers in it, and I remember seeing the car seat. My heart dropped into my stomach. It was terrifying.
15-month-old Henry Knuff was in that car seat. He was hurt much worse than Cheyenne. His mom, Kelsey Dials, described the scene later.
I got out immediately, ran to Henry's side to see if he was okay, and I saw that his mouth was bleeding. Not sure what that was from.
Although he was in the back seat, he'd suffered a serious head injury and had to have surgery and wound up in a medically induced coma. He's still on anti-seizure medication. An attorney for his parents says the boy is still struggling with his injuries. Cheyenne Erickson has problems of her own.
I was charged with criminal vehicular operation resulting in great bodily harm.
That's a felony. It's typically what drunk drivers get charged with when they hit and injure someone.
I pled guilty to that in January.
She's also had to drop out of high school and take another job to pay her restitution. Now she's telling her story, hoping that drivers in Minnesota will take the risks of distracted driving more seriously if they know what the stakes can be. Erickson says she cringes when she sees other people in cars, on their phones, doing things other than driving and watching what they're doing. She says she thinks of Henry and what she did every day.
I don't think anyone really takes it seriously because they're all like, it's not going to happen to me. It only happens to other people. You know, I'm invincible. I can do this. This is me multitasking and not screwing up. But it's like one day, one of these days, you're going to find out that you're completely wrong.
That's already happening to thousands of other people, officials say. Donna Berger is the director of the state's Office of Traffic Safety. She says distracted driving played a role in nearly 17,000 crashes last year and killed more than 50 people on Minnesota roads.
In the 1970s, drinking and driving was out of control. And now today the culture is, it's not acceptable to drink and drive. People look at people and go, oh no, you can't get behind the wheel. You need to call a cab. And distracted driving and texting and driving is coming up to that where we need people to speak up. And if you see someone, you know, engaging in a distracted behavior, you need to speak up and say, that's not okay. You're putting your life in danger. You're putting my life in danger.
Meanwhile, law enforcement has stepped up efforts to stop distracted driving. In a crackdown earlier this month across Minnesota, police cited more than 900 drivers for texting behind the wheel during a 6-day campaign that ended April 18th. Overall, texting while driving citations have nearly quadrupled in Minnesota since 2010. But Cheyenne Erickson says drivers need to worry more about the people in the car ahead of them, like Henry Knuff, than a cop with a citation book behind them.
Put your phone down. Put it in the glove box. Put it in the trunk. Don't look at it. If you need to, if you absolutely need to, you pull over. Pull over into a parking lot or on the shoulder of the highway or the freeway or wherever you are. I mean, if it's really that important, just stop. Stop what you're doing.
Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
May Day celebrations take place this weekend, and in the Powderhorn neighborhood of Minneapolis, there's a huge annual festival and parade. One of the featured groups in the parade is a local Aztec dance company. In this installment of Minnesota Public Radio's Young Reporters series, Jocelyn Navarro-Cano tells us one goal of the group is to share Mexican culture, and a side benefit is what it gives some of the dancers.
This is my dance group, Calpulli Quetzalcoatlicue, at a recent performance. Our colorful clothing, or regalia, is set up by a distinctive headpiece with feathers of many shapes, colors, and sizes. Leather ankle bracelets covered with seeds help our footsteps set the beat for the drum. We move back and forth in unison as the drum sounds fill the air. We carry chimales and ayacachlis, which might remind one of shields and maracas. I've been dancing with Calpulli Quetzalcoatlicue for 3 years. The name of the group means Precious Mother Earth. We call it Quetzal for short. When I first joined, I was just a shy 8th grader. Initially, I was hesitant to participate with the group during practice, but I finally got the guts to join the circle of dancers. I became part of the Chirones, or what we call the Young Women of the Corn. It's a year when we wear identical regalia, and older dancers mentor us to help us discover our creativity and talent. When the Chilones year is over, girls make new regalia to express their individuality. My Chilone year helped me gain confidence. My dad, Luis Perez,
says he can see the changes in me.
You're not afraid to express yourself, and you're not shy anymore in front of people. You're not afraid to speak in public. That's what I noticed. You have way more energy and happier, too.
I am happier, and I'm learning a lot. For instance, as part of Quetzal, I learned that my Aztec ancestors preserved their culture through music and dance. The Aztec culture that was kept alive in Mexico has reached the U.S. One of our dances honors our tradition of planting, and our steps represent the sowing of the land so we can plant seeds. Quetzal has helped me get a fuller picture of my heritage, something I have not gotten in school. My dad agrees.
We are here in the USA, and so I was pretty sure that they won't teach anything about that in schools here.
Kalpuli Quetzalcoatlicue has been around since 2001. The group was founded by Susana de Leon with the mission to bring people together as a community through dance. But Susana says dancing is only one aspect of the group's work. Quetzal is more like a family.
When you need someone to support you emotionally, those people are there for you. And when you need to support somebody emotionally, you also feel useful being there. But it's just not being there, but being there in a cultural way.
Susana sets the tone for that support. When she's not working as a lawyer, she spends time mentoring and encouraging young women like me. She's been a role model for me because of her strong leadership skills. My leadership skills have grown as a result.
You have transformed into this very strong young woman. And I cannot take all the credit because I said you have a very strong family. But Quetzal did help you be fearless in public.
I now recruit new members to Quetzal and mentor girls like 14-year-old Mayela de Luna, who joined the group last year. At a recent rehearsal, Mayela told me she was shy, like me, when I first joined Quetzal. But the members made her feel welcome.
And they also made me feel comfortable around them where I can be myself and just show them who I really am.
That's how I feel too. And I'm less afraid to try new things, like our recent performance at a shopping mall. The organizers gave us the space, and in return, we shared some of our culture. With our last dance, we gave thanks for the opportunity to keep our culture alive. Quetzal really changed the way I live and look at life. How, you may ask, does a dance group change someone and help them grow so much? Well, this isn't just any dance group. This is Kalpuli Quetzal Coatlicue. I'm Jocelyn Navarro Cano, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And you can see pictures of the Aztec dancers and hear other stories from our Young Reporters series at nprnews.org. That's the NPR News Update for Friday, May 1st. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.